Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome everybody to episode 44 of Push Dose EMS, your monthly educational offering from the Milwaukee County Office of Emergency Management. I'm your host, Jeff Matcha. Joining me today is my list of usual suspects and a special guest. So going around the circle, I see Chief Medical Director, Dr. Ben Weston. Dr. Weston, welcome.
Thank you, Jeff. Hello, everyone.
Assistant Medical Director, Dr. Tom Growley. Dr. Growley, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And our special guest for this episode, former paramedic for the city of Milwaukee, now off in the world. And I'll let him get into a little bit more introduction here in a moment with Dr. Growley, but welcome Sean Duffy. Sean, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And now with a message from medical direction, Dr. Ben Weston.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. Hello, everyone. And thank you again for joining. So in today's podcast, we're going to talk about an issue that I think is on the minds of a lot of our EMS providers, as well as much of the general public. In the tragic death of Elijah McClain, there's certainly much to be learned on how we can do better by our patients. And while we talk some about the details of the case, we're going to shift to a conversation about how we can more broadly best approach and treat patients with all sorts of varieties of presentation, including perceived agitation. Now, in Milwaukee County, from a medical direction to frontline provider level, we work to do our very best by our patients, providing high quality, equitable, evidence-based, and patient-centered care. And it's no different for patients identified as having agitation. So here we'll discuss best practices and where we're at in our system to ensure the highest level of patient care in all of our encounters. How best to interact with law enforcement on the scene, why we removed from our vocabulary the term agitated delirium, or racially charged, inequitably applied, and ultimately inappropriately approached term, and how we do approach agitation in our system with a measured, health-oriented, and patient-centered approach. So I think EMS providers at all levels will hopefully find much to gain from this podcast. And we're pleased to have Sean Duffy joining us for his expert commentary as well. Thank you, and I'll hand it back to you, Jeff.
Thank you, Dr. Weston. Certainly is a topical and pertinent discussion. So without further ado, let's head right into the discussion with Dr. Growley and Sean.
Today, we're going to talk about the Elijah McClain case. So this was something that has gotten a lot of conversation in EMS. It was a 23-year-old man who was apprehended by police, given ketamine for chemical restraint from EMS, and tragically died. So from this encounter, the two paramedics that provided care for Mr. McClain were convicted of criminally negligent homicide. One also was convicted of an assault charge, and they're both going to be sentenced to jail. One of them was sentenced to 5 years in prison, and the other one were waiting on their sentencing. So rightfully so, this has created a lot of conversation in the EMS world around ketamine, around chemical sedation and EMS. And, you know, while there's nothing that we can do to reverse this really tragic death, as healthcare professionals, we have a duty to reflect on our own practices and experiences, see what we can learn from adverse events all over, both in and outside of our system, and really determine how we can do better for our patients. And we'd be remiss if we didn't highlight that while this is the first case where EMS providers have been convicted in a criminal trial for patient care, this is not the first case surrounding death in custody with or without the use of ketamine. And these cases impact African American and racial minority patients at a higher rate than that of the general population. And it's important that we really work together to make sure that all patients, regardless of their race, economic background, that everyone has good health outcomes. So today, to help me with this discussion, I've got Sean Duffy. He describes himself as a mostly retired Milwaukee Fire Department paramedic and lawyer. So Sean, tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Sure. I graduated University of Wisconsin Law School in 1986, practiced in Milwaukee for the next 13 years, handling civil trials and appeals, then kind of got tired of that, joined the Milwaukee Fire Department in 1999. Started as a firefighter EMT, advanced eventually to lieutenant paramedic, was a bus on paramedic units for about 8 years on the north and south sides. And then I finished up the last 2 years as EMS education coordinator for the department and retired in 2019.
Well, it's great to have you back and, you know, continuing to help us kind of move our system forward, even though you've you know, been retired for a few years. So let's start and get into this case a little bit. So can you walk us through what happened with the Elijah McClain case?
Sure. Elijah McClain, at the time of the incident, was a 23-year-old black male, 5'7" tall and 140 pounds, walking home from work in Aurora, Colorado, wearing a ski mask because family said he had anemia and was always cold. He stopped at a gas station, and he was walking with a bag of his purchases in one hand and a cell phone in the other, earbuds in his ears, and listening to music. Somebody called and reported him as acting suspiciously as he was waving and swinging his arms as he walked. No mention of any crimes or weapons, but the police were dispatched to check on him. So at 10:42, the police saw McClain. At 10:43, the officer got out of his car and made contact with him, asked him to stop. McClain apparently didn't initially hear him. Then he turns off his music, tells him he's walking home. The officer grabs him by the arm within 10 seconds of getting out of his vehicle, spins him around. Second officer grabs the other arm. McClain starts saying that he's different, he's an introvert, and asks the cops to respect his boundaries. He's holding his hands against his chest. The police officers try to pull him away. When one arm gets loose, one officer says, yells to the others that he's trying to reach for your gun. So at 10:44, another minute later, officers take McClain to the ground. One officer applies a carotid hold twice. McClain may have briefly lost consciousness. One officer pins one of his arms to the ground. The other twists his arm behind him, pops three times, and McClain apparently vomits. 10:45, the police call for the fire department. Between 10:45 and 10:54, officers continue to use pain compliance on McClain, kneeling on his muscles and joints, sitting and kneeling on him. Once he's handcuffed, they continue to kneel on his triceps, apply a wrist lock to his hands, straddle and pin his legs. All this time, McClain's apologizing, offering his name and ID, says he doesn't believe in guns or violence, tells the officers they're phenomenal, beautiful, that they're really strong. He apologizes for peeing himself, and he says he's having trouble breathing. So a fire engine arrives at 10:54 with a paramedic lieutenant, a paramedic firefighter, and two firefighters. But McClain at that time was lying on the ground on his side in handcuffs. Police were sometimes holding him down with just one hand. McClain would occasionally move, and the officers tell him to stop it. The officer tells the paramedic that McClain must be on drugs, was really agitated, needed to be restrained. The officers didn't describe all the pain compliance they had done. The officers may have told a firefighter about the carotid hold and the unconsciousness, but the paramedics may not have heard it. So one of the paramedics stands by McClain's feet, observes him for 1 minute, later describing him as hyper-aggressive, and concludes that his behavior is consistent with excited delirium. So while the fire personnel are standing by, the officers are rolling McClain one side to the other, searching his pockets. McClain's responding. He's saying, ow, saying, stop, please, when they kneel on his, put their body weight on him. The officer says, well, stop fighting us then. McClain says, I'm trying. Then he says, I can't feel. Please help me. And those are his apparently his last words. One firefighter apparently bent down to examine McClain, but the paramedic was standing off to the side observing the police officer press down on McClain for 30 to 40 seconds without doing anything. The paramedic told the police officers they'll give ketamine when an ambulance arrives. Apparently, they'd called for a private ambulance. The officers are telling the paramedic that McClain was fighting with incredible strength. But while they're doing this, an officer is shaking McClain, asking him if he's all right, and he's not making any response at all. Private ambulance arrives at 10:56 with additional paramedics. The paramedic lieutenant, the one who was just sentenced to the 5 years, estimated McClain's weight at 190 pounds or 95 kilograms instead of his true weight of 140 pounds or 70 kilograms. the Aurora protocol dosed the ketamine at 5 mg/kg, would be 475 based on the lieutenant's estimate, ordered 500 milligrams. As he was preparing to give the ketamine, McLean is just gasping and making guttural noises, doesn't move for apparently at least a minute before the injection's given. So the injection's given at 11 p.m., and while they're waiting for the ketamine to take effect, the fire paramedic tells the private paramedic it took all the officers to hold McLean down, that he was still fighting despite pain compliance, that he was tachycardic and having excited delirium. 11:01, the officers and the meds lifted McLean to the cot. He's limp with reddish vomit coming out of his nose and mouth. Someone says, let's get him inside and suction him. 11:03, he's moved into the ambulance on the cot. The fire lieutenant, the one that was sentenced to the 5 years, is concerned about his airway, wants him suctioned. While they're doing this, they realize he's not breathing, confirm no carotid pulse, begin CPR. He's taken to the hospital, circulation's restored in the ER, stays in ICU. A few days later, declared brain dead and removed from life support.
Yeah, so thanks for walking us through, you know, all the details of that. And I think, you know, one thing we should keep in mind while we're having this discussion is, just like with any quality improvement case discussion that we have, like, we're here to look at these things very objectively and just say, hey, how can we do better? What lessons can we learn? We're not here to pass judgment, you know, no matter how we feel about one thing or another, but to just have a very, you know, open discussion about how we can do better. Okay. So Sean and I, you know, had a discussion about this before, and we kind of landed on three main takeaways that we think are worth diving in a little further. The first would be talking about the appropriate assessment and selection for patients that do require sedation, chemical sedation. Secondly, having a conversation about safely administering medications, and that includes some post-sedation monitoring. And then thirdly, talk about the interaction with police and EMS on scene, because, you know, clearly this is a really, really important thing. These are all situations where we'll be interacting with cops. And it's important that we all work together to do what's safe for the patient, what's safe for everybody, and make sure that everybody's kind of staying in their own lane while collaborating. So let's talk about the patient assessment a little bit. So Sean, can you tell us a little bit about how you identify somebody who might benefit from chemical restraint as a paramedic?
I've given ketamine on, I wouldn't say several occasions, probably less than five. But in each of the cases where I've given ketamine, the patients have basically been whirlwinds of motion, not really responding to verbal cues, not responding to painful stimuli, thrashing about, and really unable to be safely restrained by multiple police and EMS personnel. To me, that's the picture of, if you want to call it excited delirium, or if you just want to call it a patient who is in need of medical restraint.
Yeah, and I think that the other thing to kind of bring up here, and we'll talk about this term excited delirium a little bit later, is that, you know, what you describe is somebody who's having, you know, severe agitation, who's a clear threat to harm themselves and others. And there are situations, and we'll be rolling out a new updated guideline to cover this topic in April here, but there are situations where some people might benefit from a little bit of medication. You know, we'll be rolling out a medicine called olanzapine as an example, and we'll get more into this again with that conversation. But, you know, maybe a little bit of medication to help them relax, help calm some mild agitation, but not necessarily needing, you know, a hefty dose of a stronger medicine like ketamine that would completely restrain and immobilize the patients. You know, certainly there are times when that's indicated. And I think what you described is a good way to think about that. Patients who are not redirectable, we've tried verbal de-escalation, and we're still unable to get the patient to a point where we can safely take care of them. You know, I think about some situations besides these people that you encounter, other situations that I've heard of with this are people that are, you know, were in a bad car accident and they're in the car and they're too combative and you can't extricate them. You know, you can't just leave them in the vehicle until they go unresponsive to pull them out. So there are situations, again, where they're a threat to themselves, to others, where you need to get them sedated rapidly so that you could provide the best care for them. any sort of chemical restraint is going to create some risk for patients, you know. But in some cases, the risks really outweigh the benefits. And that's what we should think about with any intervention that we do in EMS, but especially for this. You know, if you can't care for someone who's medically ill, you need to be able to calm them down, to help them relax so that you could do this. And besides the EMS implications, I've really spent a lot of time considering my practice as an ER doc with this. My patient assessment in a lot of these cases has really revolved around this mantra of if they can speak, their airway's intact, they're perfusing their brain, you know, so they're stable enough for me to, you know, give them a hefty dose of a medicine. But I'm not really sure if this is enough, you know. So Sean, can you speak a little bit more about like what type of assessment you would recommend before, you know, we're giving somebody ketamine, or if you have any other thoughts on, you know, patient selection for ketamine?
Yeah, I mean, we obviously try to do the kind of universal assessment that we perform on most patients with this patient. You know, you assess their level of consciousness, assess their orientation if you can, at least, you know, try to put a hand on them to assess their skin temperature. As far as monitoring, I mean, if you can get an SpO2 on a finger, do a finger stick. If you can put a cardiac monitor on, get vital signs, blood pressure might be a little much to ask for. And I guess the bottom line is, if you can do most of these things successfully, then that's probably not a patient that is in dire need of ketamine, because you need a certain amount of cooperation to get all that done. When we're talking about these classic ketamine patients, you might be lucky to get a hand on some part of them that's being held by the police to see if they're diaphoretic or not, which is one of the classic signs of this excited delirium diagnosis. You can at least get a sense of their level of orientation, whether they're responding to anything you're saying. You can get an idea of certainly their respiratory rate. You might be able to get a hand to try to get a pulse. You might be able, you know, if the police are holding their hands still enough, you might be able to get a drop of blood for a glucose. You might be able to put an SpO2 monitor on. Realistically, in a ketamine type patient, that's probably all you're going to be able to do. But as we know, hypoglycemia and hypoxemia can cause combative behavior. So getting an SpO2 monitor and getting a blood glucose would be important things to do if you can.
Yeah, I think, Sean, those are a lot of really good points, you know, and I think that, you know, when I think of ketamine, you know, when I'm going to give somebody ketamine in the emergency department, like for a procedure, like I want to put a joint back in place, you know, before I would give them, you know, these high doses of ketamine, I would have them on a cardiac monitor. I'd check vital signs. I would do a good airway assessment, you know, and have a really good plan to know what I'm doing and really assess the safety of this. You know, but in these settings where you're needing to give this medicine, you, like you said, you don't really have the ability to do all of that. So I think we really got to think more about what other parts of an assessment we could do that give us the best idea of what the patient's perfusion status is and what risk we're taking by giving them the medication. And I really like your comment on it. You know, if somebody's calm enough for you to be able to put a cardiac monitor on them and do a 12 lead and all this stuff, like, that might be your sign that ketamine might not be the right answer for them. So I like to think about it from an ABC standpoint. So from an airway standpoint, you can think a lot about patient positioning. How are they being held by the police? Is there a way I can work with the police to try to get them held a little bit differently, somewhere that might have their airway just a little bit better than if they're like prone face down? But again, I realize there might be limitations here. Beyond that, I think about what sort of anatomical airway considerations they might have just on a normal day. You know, if it's like a 450-pound patient who probably has sleep apnea on a good day, you know, I'm going to have a higher risk of airway issues when they're being held in a position where they're not able to breathe as well. From a breathing standpoint, you know, looking at rate, rhythm, and quality from a distance, these are things that you can monitor. And then I think you did a good job highlighting, you know, things you can get from a skin exam. Now, I think, like, you know, we talked about in this case, talked about this idea of excited delirium a couple times. And this was a term that came up again in this case and was utilized by the providers here. But, you know, I think it's worth noting that this term has really fallen out of favor. So the new word that they use to re-describe excited delirium, because it has been very racially charged, and it's been used as like a diagnosis for potential cause of death. But the problem is that it really doesn't get to why people were so agitated and why people were confused and why they were hyperactive. And I think that's kind of what was missing, you know, what's really missing there. And even the updated term, which is hyperactive delirium with severe agitation, I'm personally not a huge fan of this because I'd rather think critically about, I've got this really agitated patient who's really combative, who's extremely diaphoretic and altered. And instead of just putting a name on it, how about I think about what could be causing this? You had talked about a finger stick, Sean. You're right, like hyperglycemia, hypoglycemia. You know, we think about sympathomimetic overdoses can cause this. Other things that can cause severe agitation like this might be hypotension, somebody who's periarrest, severe hypoxia. You know, I think about, again, those car accident patients that are combative and you're having a hard time extricating them. They're probably so hyperactive and so agitated because they have all this sympathetic surge trying to cope for their hemorrhagic shock state that they're in. So instead of just putting a name on it, taking a minute to say, hey, this patient is severely agitated, severely combative. You know, what are the things that could be going on? Is there any other information I can get from police, from looking at the scene, that might give me an idea of what the etiology is? So then I have a better idea of, once I get them restrained, how I can best take care of them, as well as have a good idea and appreciation for really what risks are being taken when we decide that restraint with ketamine is necessary in these situations.
And it's worth noting that after this incident, both the city of Aurora and the state of Colorado did investigations, and both of them suggested that ketamine not be discarded as a drug because it's the best drug we know about balancing risk and benefit to deal with this kind of patient. At the same time, the state of Colorado rejects the term of excited delirium, like we've been talking about, again, because it opens the door to racially discriminatory treatment, et cetera. And the way I kind of look at it is, excited delirium is a controversial diagnosis, and it's more of a description than anything else. But by the same token, we can't ignore the fact that too many seemingly healthy people suddenly drop dead during struggles with the police. And so regardless of whether we completely understand the pathophysiology of the phenomenon, it seems that the best thing for the patient is to interrupt this process as quickly as possible. It puts me in mind of, we don't really understand exactly how Tylenol reduces fever, but it doesn't prevent us from administering Tylenol to reduce fever. Likewise, we may not yet completely understand the pathophysiology of people dropping dead during these struggles with the police, but if ketamine proves to be an effective medication to interrupt that whatever cascade is going on, just because we don't completely understand the mechanism is no reason not to use it if it's otherwise indicated.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, and there are research studies that have, you know, looked at the safety of ketamine. You know, there's one in particular in pediatric patients that were in a controlled hospital setting that were getting ketamine for procedural sedation. And they looked at the cases where ketamine was given in too high of a dose, mistakenly given in too high of a dose. You know, one of the cases that they looked at in the study was up to 100 times the indicated dose of ketamine, and found that in these patients that had really nothing else major going on, that were clearly monitored, but didn't really have any other complicating factors like hemodynamic instability, what else might be causing the issues with being restrained, you know, ketamine was great, and they didn't have any adverse events in this study. And I think the key here is that, you know, like you had said, ketamine is good for what it does, but any medicine, even one that we talk about generally is a little sympathomimetic or hemodynamically neutral in most settings, has risks associated with it. And even these leadership bodies in Colorado, you know, recognize that, you know, if you have someone that's ill, like there's no quicker way to chemically calm someone down, chemically relax them so you can intervene and take care of them than the amount of speed by which ketamine can accomplish that when used appropriately. But like we had said before, you know, with any of this, and I love what you had said, even though we don't understand why it's happening, the key is that it does happen, you know, and we might not understand the total physiology behind why people are dying, but we know that ketamine is the best option. And I think it's worth highlighting that, you know, if you were to load someone with benzodiazepines, they might have the same outcome, you know, as these people who are getting ketamine. We just don't have as many of those cases to look at because ketamine is a good option for these patients that are really, really agitated.
And on the, since you mentioned pediatric dosage, perhaps this is a good place to tell my own horror story of what makes me a little bit sympathetic to the paramedics in this case. We were called to a private ambulance on scene with a patient that was unresponsive. So we get there and we open up the back doors of the ambulance, and far from unresponsive, this guy's a whirlwind, and these two poor private EMTs are doing their absolute best just to keep him on the cot. So my partner and I jump in, and I think I grab his legs and tell the partner that, you know, this is a ketamine patient. So I estimate his weight at about 150 pounds. He was kind of a string bean. And during the wrestling match there, forgot to change pounds into kilograms. So calculated 3 milligrams per kilogram based on 150 instead of 75. The OEM max at the time was 300 milligrams. So we gave him the 300 milligram max and understandably fell asleep. And once the wrestling match was over, we realized our error, reported it to the hospital. I took one of the EMTs along with us just to make sure we could manage his airway, maintain an airway all the way to the hospital, monitoring him in every way we had available. We got the Children's. He was 17 years old, and I handed him off to the Children's doc. I told him about the overdosage and took a look at him, assessed him a little, and said he's just going to sleep a little longer. So that made me feel a little better. And actually, the other thing the Colorado investigation suggested as a way to avoid some of these medication errors was standard medications in three bands, 300 milligrams for small, 400 for medium, 500 for large males, and 50 milligrams less in each step for females. So by that token, we ended up giving the lowest dose that would have been given under that kind of protocol. But like I say, if we would have overdosed the patient on fentanyl, for example, if we were treating a orthopedic pain or something, I think we would have been much busier on the way to the hospital maintaining their respirations and probably giving Narcan to reverse it. So ketamine, in my personal experience, has proven to be, you know, the downside to ketamine has proven to be outweighed by the benefits.
Yeah, and I think that's great, and thanks for sharing that story. You know, and I think that ketamine is definitely a medication that can lead to medical errors, and we could have a whole other great podcast discussion on medication errors. You know, but I think you highlighted some other good factors here that certainly contribute to medication errors besides the medication, the drug factors itself with the calculations. You know, you're getting your medications up in a situation where you're busy, your hands are full, you know, you have a lot of cognitive load going on with this patient and trying to juggle everything else that's on scene, you know, and all those things can make your job as an EMS professional challenging, whether it's for giving ketamine or managing an airway or, you know, I mean, pick your task, you know, starting an IV on somebody that's screaming at you, right? So thanks for sharing that, you know, and I think you highlighted kind of the right things to do, like good assessment, letting people know about it and letting us investigate how we can make it better. So again, one of the things you highlighted in that case was like how you monitor patients. So, you know, what would you recommend? What's a good assessment to do after somebody, you know, has been given ketamine and they've calmed down and now you can approach them more? What kind of assessment do you do? And how do you monitor the patient en route to the hospital?
Well, first and foremost, put them in a, you know, probably a semi-Fowler position to make sure their airway is going to remain open. Make sure not to strap them in too tight to limit chest expansion, everything to Because to me, in one of these cases where they've been struggling with the police, they're working hard, they have weight put on them, they're probably going to be hypoxic if nothing else is going on. So, you know, improve their oxygenation that way and by probably high flow too, cardiac monitor, SpO2, some of the Colorado state investigation specifically requires end-tidal CO2 monitoring, and that's a good idea as well for someone who's been in respiratory compromise. A blood sugar, if you haven't already got it, since that helped in or rule out a possible cause. Yeah, all the regular vital signs, blood pressure, pulse, respirations, skin. You might see some improvement if they started out really diaphoretic. You might note some improvement. They might start drying out on the way to the hospital. And then really, I mean, go through your regular mnemonic device on altered mental status. See if you can come up with any possible reversible causes.
Great. And then I think I'd be curious your thoughts, you know, on like in that pediatric patient you shared, you were sure to grab an extra set of hands to come with you, you know, and I know that not everybody maybe has that same luxury, but, you know, I think that if you have somebody that you gave ketamine to, you know, right now they seem like they might be stable and they're well controlled, but here's your thoughts on just the fact that you gave ketamine. Is that enough for you to bring an extra set of hands with you in the back of the rig, you know, when that resource is available?
In the usual ketamine case where the person's struggling, you give them the proper dose of ketamine. They, you know, fall asleep over the course of a couple of minutes. They're still breathing fine. You start monitoring them to get them into the back of the ambulance with your paramedic partner, especially given the short transports we have the luxury of in Milwaukee County. If the person is oxygenating well, and you got them in a good position and there are no other warning signs in monitoring, I'd feel comfortable not taking an extra EMT. In the case that I outlined, given the overdose, I was just worried about respiratory compromise somewhere along the way. But I've found no sign of any significant respiratory compromise with ketamine, like the kind you might expect with morphine or fentanyl. So I'd be a little more comfortable after ketamine than one of those drugs.
Great. Yeah. And I think the good thing I like that you highlighted too is after we've done a full assessment and made sure that we're good and we're safe, you know, then we're going to keep a close eye on the route. But at that point, you know, I've got a short transport, I've got everything in place, and I'm be good with myself. So great. So I know this has been a really great discussion. Let's kind of transition a little bit and talk about police. So we know that we're going to enter these situations with police. You know, how can we work with police ahead of time before we even get on scene, before these cases happen, to make sure that really we're all on the same page when we're trying to manage these patients together?
It's one of the more difficult things on this job. In a case like this, where the patient might be, you know, significantly compromised and on a bad path, and that it might be at least partially because of the interaction with the police, then it's more like we should be the ones responsible. We should be the highest authority on scene. We are assessing and treating this medical patient, and the police are there to assist us in making the scene safe and keeping the patient as restrained as possible while still maximizing their health. Now, that isn't necessarily an easy handoff to make at 3 a.m. when the police have been wrestling with this guy and they're a little bit hypoxic too. They got maybe a little tunnel vision going on. You show up in your smock and all of a sudden want them to get off the patient and sit them up. You got to be diplomatic, but also you need some support, I think, from the back room. I mean, I think we need, and the state of Colorado recognized this in their investigation, you need some ground up training both on the police and EMS side to make this handoff more effective and more efficient. We can't really expect individual paramedics to be, you know, making this case in the middle of the night with police that are wrestling with this person that they think is dangerous. Both sides have to be trained that the primary job of the paramedic on scene is to assess and treat the patient and that if they have to ask the police to change their behavior a little to facilitate that, then that's what should happen. They shouldn't just say, hey, we're taking this guy into custody. We just want you to check him out. Well, I think that's kind of the problem with the McLean case. It almost sounded like the paramedics considered themselves an adjunct to the police and were giving ketamine basically to make the police officer's job easier. That's not really the way to look at it. So I think it's too much to ask for the paramedic on scene to do it alone. I think it takes buy-in by both whatever city you're in, fire department and police department training academies to drill that in from the very start.
Yeah, I like how you talked about like the preparation and kind of leading up. You know that we're going to be here together. So let's plan together. Let's train. You know, let's work on this so that we can collaborate better when we're on scene. And I also just want to reiterate what you said about this being a medical situation. And I know that when we come in at 3 a.m. and, you know, we want to have control over the patient, that can be challenging. And that's why the discussion beforehand, you know, really matters, because before we give any medicine, we're going to want to do our own assessment and come up with our own plan, not necessarily based on what the cops want. So I like the way you mentioned that about us being able to take ownership instead of being an arm of the police. So
I would also say that, you know, like we've talked about already, perhaps some small changes in how the police are handling the patient might obviate the need for ketamine. I mean, if the patient's prone with people piled on his back, obviously that's a problem. Some patients, all you got to do is turn them over, sit them up, de-escalate verbally. The police can still, you know, keep hands on them. We can put a O2 mask on for fit protection, and we might be able to calm things down and interrupt this cascade just by verbal and changes in physical handling of the patient that might remove the need for ketamine. So that's all part of trying the least restrictive and least significant interventions first.
Great. Really great points. So to kind of summarize a little bit, you know, I know you don't actively practice as a paramedic anymore, but you know, anything that you've learned from these situations or kind of after reflecting more on this case that you would do differently if you were back in the field, or if you had like 1 to 2, you know, a couple of very small takeaways for the people listening about how they can do better for these patients, what would you say?
Well, even though I've always been an advocate of the paramedic being the highest medical authority on scene, I probably wasn't taking as strong a line sometimes with the police as I could have. So I would certainly hope that a case like this and other cases like that that I've seen since leaving the department would, you know, make me a little more assertive with the police when I see something that's going on that can be changed and perhaps avoid a catastrophic outcome. And that's one way to approach the police. I mean, there are certain things we can do to facilitate a better outcome and to avoid a catastrophic outcome. And the police have to be trained in that so that they don't have to be convinced of that every time. But saying that, I think I'd be a little more assertive now, and I hope that today's paramedics are.
That's a really great point, and I'll share my big takeaways on how I've changed. And I think the first is really along those lines, like being mindful of the, I don't want to say peer pressure, but you know, the tone on scene and what other people may want. You know, I have one story myself about being in the trauma bay with a patient who was sick and agitated. And I had police, multiple other physicians. I mean, there were a ton of people in this room, nurses, everybody very well-intentioned, you know, who were kind of coming up to me and say like, hey, Tom, we got to give this guy some ketamine so we can take care of him, you know? And it, you know, it's hard when you've got 40 people standing around you, you know, like telling you, give ketamine, give ketamine, give ketamine, give ketamine, to kind of take a step back and being like, hold on a second, you know, let's like think about this, whether this is really needed or if there are other options that we can consider, other things that we can pursue. So I think that's one thing. You know, I think my other two big takeaways are a better assessment. You know, again, I like to think I'm a very well-intentioned physician. And when I have somebody that's being held down by a bunch of people, I try to like give them space so they have room to work. But what that's meant is that I'm further away from the patient than I probably should be, and thinking about how I can get a little closer in a safe way and not get in other people's ways that are trying to hold the patient down, and and do a little bit more of a better assessment to get a better idea of what their perfusion status is beyond if they can speak, if they can breathe, and think about that. And then the third thing is, if I'm going to give someone a dose of ketamine to put them asleep to like reduce a shoulder fracture, I'm going to do something called a timeout before where, and I love these timeouts, but it's like a little pause where I kind of review my summary assessment. I talk about what medicine we're going to do. Everybody around me agrees on the medicine, the dose, the patient weight. We make sure that we have the monitoring equipment up. And then, you know, I would give the ketamine medicine. I've never once done that before giving ketamine for chemical restraint. And even though a lot of people I know all do timeouts, I've never once seen somebody do a timeout before giving ketamine for chemical restraint. So, and it's the same dose, you know, pretty similar doses. So I think that's how my big practice is changing is like, hey, you know what? Like this is a medicine that is safe, but there is risk here. And while I might not be able to get as good of an assessment when I do this for chemical restraint as I did for, you know, like a shoulder dislocation reduction, like, you know, I can have the cardiac monitor at the patient's bedside instead of, you know, waiting, having it wait for me in the back of the rig in EMS setting or, you know, pulled out of the room. Have this stuff near the patient to make that part of my time out and make sure that we all agree on the weight, the medication, the indications, and that we're doing this as safely as possible. So thanks, Sean, for joining us today. It's been great to have you. This has been a really great discussion, and I look forward to having you on again in the future when, you know, hopefully nothing like this comes up, but something else that might be great to lend your expertise to.
My pleasure. Happy to help, and I hope the rank and file find it helpful, not just some old retiree spouting off how they should be doing their business from the comfort of their own home.
All right. Thanks, Sean.
You bet.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Growley. Thanks, Sean. We greatly appreciate everyone taking their time out today to have a listen to what's really a kind of an important conversation, some best practices. So I hope that was meaningful to everybody that took the time out to listen. We appreciate your time. Stay safe, and we'll see you next month. Thanks, all.